Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. I'd like to welcome everyone this Sunday afternoon. Lumpo Sumedho is away in Italy at the moment, and I think beginning at the end of the week he'll also be doing a two-week retreat beginning at the retreat center here. So I'll be joining you these Sunday afternoons for the next this week and the next two following. So the theme for today's talk is that of forgiveness, and this is a perennially useful theme. And when this came up as suggested as a topic, I felt it would be a very helpful, very useful, interesting to explore. Our culture here in the West is has quite a long history of the culture of vengeance and the sort of Judeo-Christian conditioning, but also it's not totally isolated to Western Europe, but in Asia, also other parts of the world, most places where human beings have lived, there has been that instinct to take our revenge when we experience some kind of hurt, when we are damaged or offended or wounded, that there's an instinctual, reactive habit, a pattern that we want to cause the other, that which has hurt us, we want to cause that being, those beings' harm in return. We want our vengeance. And that's a strong conditioning, particularly if there is a religious backup to it. It is often quoted that the Old Testament kind of sentiment of "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." I did look that up actually, but it doesn't seem as though it does actually say that in the Bible. It's one of those frequent misquotings, but it's there in our culture anyway. "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord," so that the feeling is that there's some kind of official sanction to punish, or to that if someone causes us harm, they should suffer in return. And there's also a sense within that of a feeling of if we've been hurt or something bad has been done to us, it's almost like our duty to hang on to that. That it's in a way the basis of honor killings, as they are called, quote unquote honor killings, is that the family honor has been defiled, or the spiritual honor has been defiled, and the only way that can be restored is by killing the offender. And it can seem to be the right thing to do, that if you just forgive and forget, just sort of drop something, that you're not doing your duty. You're not fulfilling what should be done. So that's a powerful force in our thinking, isn't it? That there can be that sense of, well, I would like to drop it, but I shouldn't, because it's my duty to hang on to this and carry this resentment, this grudge around with me forever. Certainly, those of us here who had that kind of a feeling, it can be perplexing. Because maybe something in us wants to just drop the issue or not make anything of it, but then there's a sense of, well, no, it shouldn't just be dropped. There should be due punishment, should be meted out. There's something, revenge should be taken somewhere or another. And one of the things that is interesting to reflect on in this respect is that the Buddha's teachings on karma and vipaka, action and its results. And the feeling that, well, wrongdoers should be punished, or that those who have caused harm, or those who have behaved in an immoral or harmful, hurtful way, that they should be punished. And also people will observe that, you know, if you say, well, we all are the recipients of our actions, that people can say, even in the time of the Buddha, they say, well, you can see people who seem to misbehave really badly, that behave in terrible ways, but yet they seem to get away with everything. They get away with murder, and the most outrageous robbers and politicians who rip everybody off left and right, they seem to be enjoying a very comfortable life, thank you very much. And sometimes good people who seem to live very virtuous and beneficial, wholesome lives seem to be suffering a lot, or life is not automatically easier or better for them on account of that. So where's the punishment, or how come they can act in such an unwholesome way and not seemingly not receive the result of it? So it's interesting that in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses, there are two discourses there side by side, the Sutta 135 and 136. And in the first one, the shorter discourse on the teachings on action, the Buddha describes how for every kind of action, every kind of disposition, there is a matching, a sort of corresponding result. So that if you're very generous or moral, then you'll be reborn looking beautiful. Or if you are one who are harmless, then you'll be gifted with the result of that will be a long life. And so he goes through many different instances of pointing out the matching consequence to the particular action. And then in the next discourse, the longer discourse on the nature of action, then he points out that you can't exactly say when and how and where the results of a particular action will ripen. And the same issue comes up, as I recall it in that very discourse, that people who seem to live an immoral life, how come they don't have some kind of immediate negative response? How come they seem to be going sort of quote unpunished? Or how come there are good people that have terrible things happen to them? And the Buddha points out that the ripening of action, the vipaka, the karmic result that comes from action, you can't predict exactly how, when, and where it's going to ripen. But there are inexorable laws that are functioning together. So we have this mixture of different influences, both that there is the actions that are taken and the results that come from them, but you can't predict when and where that result will come. Now, for most people, they want to see more immediate results. If someone's broken into your house, you want to see them taken to court, and you want to see them charged and see that justice is done. We are eager to see much more of a direct acting out of justice. To see that you can say, well, maybe in a future life this person's going to lose all their belongings, but I've just lost mine, thank you very much. So I'd rather like to see more of an apparent result sooner rather than later. And that's very natural to us. It's the most ordinary and natural thing. But the Buddha did point out these laws, the laws of karma and their result. And I feel these are very helpful to reflect on when we're thinking in terms of forgiveness. And that in us which doesn't want to forgive, that which wants to carry around resentment, negativity, that to really bear in mind the Buddha's teachings about how actions do inevitably and inexorably carry their results with them, but simply we can't predict as exactly how, where, and when they will ripen. Now, when we do carry around that kind of resentment, that sort of negativity, we want someone to be punished. In the kind of Old Testament biblical model of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, what we find within ourselves when we carry that kind of resentment around, like I'm never going to forgive, you've done me wrong, and I'm going to carry this aversion, this grudge, this resentment around with me till the end of my days, and I'm never going to let you forget it. Now, what we don't realize when we're doing that is how much we harm ourselves. And maybe the other person did do wrong. Maybe they did really badly abuse us or rob us or harm us in some kind of irreparable way. Maybe we ask God for life. But what we can miss is how we are harming ourselves in the process. And it just so happened, I'm not sure whether this person who sent me this message knew that I was going to be giving a talk about forgiveness this weekend. But this arrived a couple of days ago through the email, seemingly quite by chance. And it's from someone called Petar Lachik. And it's a story that relates to this. So I thought I'd read it out to you all. Once upon a time, a man was walking along a path. He happened to catch his foot on a lump of dried mud and tripped and hit his nose on the ground. His nose bled and he felt a sudden rage at the earth that had hurt him. He stood up and shook his fist at it. "What have I ever done to you?" he shouted. "You stub my toes, you make me dirty, you make me tired walking up your hills, and you make me fall going down them. I've had it with you." He stomped off home and got his shovel. "I'll show you," he growled. "I'll shovel you away if it takes me the rest of my life." The man viciously jabbed his spade into the ground, scooped up some dirt and flung it into the air. "That's one shovelful gone, and here goes another," he grunted to himself as he tossed up a second scoop of dirt. He worked and worked, digging furiously, trying to shovel the earth away once and for all. All afternoon he dug up dirt and threw it into the air, paying no attention to anything else. He never noticed that he was digging himself into a hole. You could see that coming, couldn't you? Right. He never noticed that he was flinging the dirt into the air and onto himself. In his fury, he never noticed the weight pressing down on him or the space growing narrower and narrower. Even when he could no longer move in his mind, he was still digging, still shoveling the earth into space. He never noticed when he finally became part of the earth that he felt injured by. And the earth never took any notice of him at all. So it's a moral tale. But isn't it curious how we can dig ourselves into those holes? And we might hear that story and go, ha 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 ha. And then, meanwhile, forgetting the last time that we did that. So, yeah, but I mean, he really did do me wrong, and I am going to, it's my duty to carry that around and resent and begrudge him that behavior forever. So, in terms of considering forgiveness, it's not necessarily overlooking the harm that's been done. There's a usefulness, a necessity to acknowledge that. But then it's also a consideration of, well, that having been done, what is a way forward that can help us all? What's something that's going to be of benefit both to myself, so I don't have to carry around this burden of aversion, hatred, negativity, and what's going to help the other person as well, or the other people? So I was reflecting on this this theme, and I was reminded of a story I heard about someone who became quite well known in this country back in the 60s and 70s. And there was someone who was a monk in this community who used to work with this fellow up in Edinburgh. His name was Jimmy Boyle. Some of you might have heard of him. And he was a gang fighter in Glasgow back in the 1960s. And he was jailed in 1967 for murder. He was I think he was the very first person to be convicted of murder after the death penalty was scrapped in Britain. And so he was locked up, and for the first 10 years of his life in jail, he fought the system tooth and nail and was a completely incorrigible prisoner. And this was the first time that the prison system didn't have the threat of the death penalty, and so they were struggling to find ways to contain people who ostensibly were never going to be out of jail for the rest of their lives, and therefore they seemingly didn't have much to lose. So Jimmy Boyle was a famously contentious and difficult argumentative prisoner who picked fights with the guards and the system as and where he could, whenever he could. And the reason why the monk who had been in our community had got to know him was because eventually Jimmy Boyle was released from jail. And the way it came about was that after struggling in the prison system for many years, they decided to try an experiment with humanizing the way of relating to the prisoners. And I believe it's in Jimmy Boyle's book called A Sense of Freedom that he wrote in. He was jailed in 67, and then I think he wrote the book A Sense of Freedom in 77. And he describes how what they did was that within Barlinnie Prison in Glasgow, they created a special unit, a sort of a super tightly contained unit within the prison. But inside that unit, then things were quite liberal, quite open. Rather than the previous procedures they'd had of pretty much locking people up, even putting the prisoners in cages, the famous, infamous cages, locking people up in solitary confinement and very vicious punishments. And Jimmy Boyle described how the great turning point came for him, where one day in a special unit, a parcel had come for him from some well-wisher outside. And then the guard gave him a pair of scissors. And as he describes, says, "You know that's a weapon." He, because up to that point, then any kind of sharp object, anything that could remotely be used to harm others was completely out of bounds. He was never going to be allowed near. And here was a guard actually handing him a weapon. And he's looking the guard in the eye and says, "You know, you realize what you're doing? You're actually putting a weapon into my hand." And then the guard stayed in the same position, still holding the scissors out to him, and gave him this look which said, "Yes, I know, I'm handing you a weapon, and I'm trusting that you're not going to stick me with it." And it was so, had such a powerful impact, it was so surprising, and so powerful a message to him that someone was actually treating him as a responsible human being for a change, that to his amazement he took the scissors and opened the parcel with them and gave the scissors back. Didn't attack the guard. And that was a turning point in his whole life. And eventually, because he was able to really turn his life and his way of relating around, eventually he got released from jail, and he started up this a prison reform charity called Inside Out, I think it was called. And that this fellow who eventually became a monk in this community, Tansobono, was working with him as a volunteer when they had the programs going in Edinburgh. Well, that really struck me, that story and the experience, because also Tansobono had known this fellow and worked with him and had hands-on experience of this man and his life story. So here was someone who the society at first was not going to forgive in any way. He was a murderer, he was to be punished, he was to be contained under duress at all costs. But no matter how hard they tried to hold him down, that all they met with was resistance and negativity. But the turning point came when he was trusted. They weren't neglecting the fact that he was a convicted killer. But they're also recognizing, along with having taken somebody's life or having been accused of that or having been convicted of that, you're also a human being and therefore worthy of respect. There's something in you that is not violent. There's something in you that is responsible, that is responsive. And so it was that gesture of trust that was able to contact that point of humanity within him and then turn his life around and then also cause his life to become a source of great benefit for many other people from many years since that time. And he became a sculptor and he put a lot of his energy went into his artwork, and I think he actually eventually married his barrister. the barrister who got him out of, the woman barrister who got him out of jail, finally they ended up getting married together. It's another story. So with the with this theme, it's important to, I feel it's important to understand that we're not just, with forgiveness, we're not just glossing over the harm that's been done. You're not pretending that that's not there or that it doesn't matter. But we're looking at what is the most skillful way of handling that. There's a chant that we do here pretty much on a daily basis, called the sharing of blessings, and probably many of you are familiar with that. And in the words of this chant, in the English goes, you know, those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. You're sharing your blessings consciously with the highest gods, the evil forces, those who are friendly, indifferent, and hostile. Now, on that instinctual level, if someone we call them evil, you know, to use, some people don't even like to use such a word, or some people that are hostile to us, why would we want to share the blessings of our life? Why do we want to share our good karma, limited amounts of good karma that we have? Why would we want to share it with people that have done us harm, or who are hostile, people who make our life more difficult? Why would we want to, in a sense, offer up the goodness of our lives to them? And something in us feels that, well, if you're being friendly towards those who are hostile, or you're being friendly towards the evildoers, those who are destructive or cruel, you are condoning their actions. They should be punished. They should be locked up, put them in the cages, punish them, off with their heads. There can be that feeling of, why on earth would you want to wish them well if they're so harmful? But to me, and it was particularly striking after we started to do this chant in English. We had done it for many years in the Pali, but not been quite such expert Pali scholars as some. It was only when we started to recite it in English that the meaning really hit home. To consciously share the goodness of your life with those who wish you harm. Isn't that strange? Isn't that amazing? And what seems so powerful and so helpful to me is that you're recognizing, yes, this person's actions are harmful, they're painful, but more negativity, more hatred is only going to make things worse. And similarly, just because I have love for you, just because I respect your nature as a living being, doesn't mean to say that I approve of all of your actions, right? And it's very easy to get those things mushed together. They get conflated very easily, don't they? Because we might feel if someone objects to our actions or criticizes our actions, they're criticizing us. They hate us. You know, if you don't approve of what I do, then you must hate me, or you must feel badly towards me. But I feel in terms of practicing Dhamma, it's most important to realize that those are two different things, that we can have complete loving kindness and respect and forgiveness. We can cultivate those qualities towards another being, but yet heartily disapprove of their actions. They're not the same thing. That just because I share the goodness of my life with you doesn't mean to say I'm glad of what you do. I disapprove of what you do doesn't mean to say I hate you or feel negativity towards you. So I feel this is an extraordinarily important principle to bring into our culture, something that comes from Buddha Dhamma that's really very, very helpful. And to be clear within ourselves that we can do that. We have that capacity to wish well to even those who do us harm, because that quality of wishing well is recognizing our common humanity, our common nature as living beings, and recognizing that if I carry around resentment, if I carry around negativity, that only creates greater division, greater disharmony, greater discord, and therefore sows the seeds of greater suffering in the future. Does that make sense? Yeah. So this is something that's really worthy of contemplation, and it happens so many times during the course of a day where we think of somebody in our family or someone that we work with or someone in the government or some figure around the world, and we look at their actions and then we think, I hate that person, or I can't stand that person, or that's really upsetting, or I feel a sense of negativity. And just to take the trouble to notice that, to see that reaction and to consider, well, wait a minute, I disapprove of their actions, or their actions seem harmful or destructive. That's not a cause for me to cultivate negativity and aversion towards that other person. To take that moment to to sort of reconsider our approach. Now, one of the things that is similarly an important principle. Again, I'm not trying to make this an occasion to put down the Judeo-Christian model, but in one of the most important things in Buddha Dhamma is there's no concept of an absolute evil. That the Buddha talked in terms of wholesomeness and unwholesomeness, but there's no such thing as in Buddhist psychology, in Buddhist teachings, as an absolute evil, and this is again a very helpful principle to digest in terms of cultivating forgiveness and a quality of compassion or loving kindness towards other beings. Say, for example, there's a very interesting discourse, again in the middle-length discourses, called the Rebuke to Mara. And this is an encounter between Mahamoggallana, who was the Buddha's second disciple, one who was most gifted with psychic powers, and Mara. And in Buddhist mythology, as most of you probably know, Mara is the Lucifer figure. He's the Satan, the Lord of Illusion, the embodiment of all unwholesomeness in Buddhist mythology. So you have this encounter between Mahamoggallana, who's the arahant, enlightened disciple of the Buddha, and Mara. And Mara's trying to cause Mahamoggallana trouble and causes this physical discomfort, and Moggallana immediately recognizes that it's Mara who's trying to get at him and say, "I know you, Mara. You can don't pretend that you're not there. I know it's you." And finally, Mara appears and they have this dialogue together. And Moggallana tells him, "You know, in a past life, I was a Mara too, and my name was Dusi, the Mara Dusi, and in that lifetime, I had a sister who was called Kali, and she had a son, and that was you. So I used to be your uncle." It's a really extraordinary dialogue. So here in this sutta, you have. Here's the Buddha's second disciple, an arahant, one of the great saints of the Buddhist tradition. And he used to be Satan in a previous life. He's the embodiment of evil in one life. And then, obviously, a few lifetimes later, he'd pulled himself out of that extraordinarily dark pattern of living and thinking and relating. And to the point where he had reached full enlightenment and was full the development to whereby he had the good karma to be born in the lifetime of Gautama Buddha and to become his second disciple. And now, mythologically, that's pretty amazing to me. You'd think, if you can imagine the amount of bad karma you create being the embodiment of evil in the universe, that's a lot of bad karma, right? Being Satan, you think, well, that's pretty irreparable. But, you know, and you might think, well, this is all just fairy tales and mythology. But it's mythology has its purposes and its power. And to me, that just having the story where someone who had been the embodiment of unskillfulness and evil in the world could rise up out of that, could evolve out of that extraordinarily dark and negative state, and then in a future lifetime to be fully enlightened, totally liberated, to become an arahant. So what that points to, at least on a mythological level, is that no wrongdoing is irreparable. No being is unredeemable. And so even if your problem is not with forgiving others, but forgiving yourself, maybe it's much easier to forgive the wrongdoings of others, but our own shortcomings are the ones that we're most critical and negative about. This is a really helpful model, I find, to consider that no matter how badly we've done things wrong, no matter how stupid our mistakes were, no matter how painful the effects of the faults that we have carried out or that which has been done to us or that which we've experienced or that which we see in the world, the harm on a family level, on a local level, on a national level, you know, the harm that's done by oppressive governments, by the ecological degradation because of various aspects of human greed, or whether it's very, very local, that to see that in terms of the Buddhist understanding of things, no wrongdoing is irreparable, is unredeemable. And again, I feel this is a really important and helpful model, particularly when if we are one who suffers a lot from guilt or from feelings of imperfection in ourselves, so a lot of self-criticism, that there's that one thing that we did that was irrevocably bad, that terrible mistake that we made, the thing that maybe people keep reminding us should be considered to be unforgivable. Just to bring that suggestion into consciousness, that there's no thing that we have done, no thing that has been done to us, nothing that has happened around us that is completely unforgivable. Similarly, the Buddha's cousin, Devadatta, who during the Buddha's lifetime made several attempts on the Buddha's life, tried to kill him several times over, caused a schism, a division in the Sangha deliberately. Incredible amounts of bad karma. Again, according to Buddhist mythology, even though as the stories go that Devadatta was eventually his bad karma piled up to such an enormous extent that the earth actually opened up and swallowed him in a sheet of flame, and then he sunk down into the lower hell realms. It's said that in a future birth, he will be a Pacheka Buddha. That's a fully enlightened Buddha, but one who doesn't form a sangha of nuns and monks, but a Pacheka Buddha in a future life. So even Devadatta, for all of the incredible harm and wrongdoing that he did in the Buddha's lifetime, the incredible unskillfulness, still that he had a lot of wholesome qualities as well. He had the good karma to be born in the same family as Gautama Buddha and to be so close, and that there's at least according to the stories, that in the future he will indeed be fully enlightened and will be a Pacheka Buddha. So again, this is a helpful symbol to us. So even if your mind at this moment might be thinking, yeah, but you don't know what I did. You know, I really should be punished. I really don't deserve ever to be happy. You know, you might be able to explain it away, but I know. So I would like to encourage a little doubt, a suspicion that maybe that judgment is faulty, and that perhaps there's a possibility that even the most ghastly wrongdoing, the most terrible mistake, the harm that we've done, is forgivable. There was a very poignant dialogue I had with someone earlier this year who she took her children and some of her nieces and nephews to the seaside one day, and she was looking after the children, and one of her nieces got into trouble in the sea. And she didn't realize that her niece was struggling, and she drowned. And so this incident, the 10-year-old niece drowning, and she was the responsible adult there, and she wasn't paying attention. It was her responsibility. It was her fault. And how that has sat with her and stayed with her and has been the sort of dominant, painful presence in her days ever since that had happened 20 years before. And so she carried that around with her and was haunted by that feeling of responsibility and sadness, the grief at the loss of her niece. And so talking with her in these terms, and how part of her mind could say, you know, I can't be forgiven, you know, it's my fault. And so in this respect, it's important to recognize, yes, we do have those feelings of regret. But that's not all and everything that we are. Just like Jimmy Boyle had been responsible for a lot of violence and destruction and pain in the way that he lived. But that's not all and everything. That's not the whole story. It's not all of what we are. And that we're not necessarily brushing aside the harm that's been done. We're not pretending it's not there. But we're also not creating self-view around that, not making that into an identity. But seeing, yes, that was an unskillful action, that was harm was done, but we can recognize the transgression, we can recognize the harm, and acknowledge it as such, and then move on from there. Another story that comes to mind, slightly less painful and poignant, was an encounter between that was described to me by a friend of mine who's a Dhamma teacher in the USA, in California, Julie Wester. And this was an incident that occurred when her daughter was about 4 years old, and her daughter Sophie was a very, very a sweet and a gentle little girl. And one day Julie was sort of tidying up in the living room, and she noticed that this little glass horse that sat on the windowsill was missing. And you know, Sophie, being a little girl, would kind of often play with the various things around the house. And so Julie said, "Sophie, what happened to the little glass horse that sits on the windowsill?" "I don't know." This froze in this blanched look of terror on her face. And Julie, being very astute, shall we try that again? So why don't you go out of the room, Sophie, and then come in and I'll try asking that question again. How about that? Okay. So then I thought this was extremely skillful, a way to help her daughter. And so Sophie went out, and then she came back in again, and Julie said, "Sophie, what happened to that little glass horse that sits on the windowsill?" "I broke it." I'm sorry. "Oh, well, that's a shame. That was a sweet thing. But I wonder where the pieces are. Maybe we can stick it back together again." "Oh, do you think so?" And so she went and got the pieces of the broken glass that Sophie had tried to hide away. And then they made it into this little task together to try and get some glue and to, you know, take the various pieces and figure out what went where and stick the horse back together again. I thought that was tremendously skillful, rather than saying, "You shouldn't lie to me, Sophie. You know, I know you broke it now. You should be a good girl." And because she could see that she was very regretful, and also that there she was telling a lie to her mother. But rather than scolding her for breaking the ornament, or scolding her for not telling the truth, I thought that was so helpful, just to say, "Well, let's just rewind here. let's just go back and try that again." And that that was a very wise and a helpful way to relate, because it certainly recognized there was something that was done that was harmful, but yet there's a way to recognize, well, it was a mistake, it was an accident. There's no need to create more difficulty and pain out of it. So in our world, there's many ways that we can deal with wrongdoing and harm. Something like that I thought was extremely skillful. On a more grand scale, one of the most powerful examples in recent times, well, not that recent now, but from the last 10-15 years, was in South Africa after the ending of apartheid. The what was called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, that was founded by the post-apartheid government, Nelson Mandela and the South African government, actually bringing in people who had been responsible for extremely, you know, harmful and destructive acts, people in the security services, people in the police and the army and in the governmental world and in all different dimensions, and or people who'd taken revenge for harmful acts done and so forth, and bringing people into the commission and talking through the acts that had been done, what had been done, and accounting for the feelings, the motivation behind it, and what was there. And I haven't read a huge number of accounts of that, but the understandably, there were some very, very intense exchanges. Similarly, they've done work of a comparable nature in Ireland as well, with the struggles in in Belfast and Northern Ireland, and there are some pretty painful and intense exchanges. But the overall result of that effort has been extraordinarily helpful, and I think that many people could never believe that South Africa could change over from a sort of the white apartheid government to a democratically elected governmental form involving the African people, Black African community, without there being a huge amount of military conflict and bloodshed. And I felt that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in particular, that very effort to acknowledge the harm that was done, to bring it out into the open, and to be able to recognize, yes, you know, what I did was harmful, what I did was destructive, but please forgive me. And similarly, on both sides of, not just for the white people, for the Black community as well, to recognize what was unskillful that was done, to recognize that and to ask for forgiveness. And obviously there's many, many difficulties and struggles in South Africa still today, but the very effort that was made in that is very very powerful and public example of how we can forgive and how we can acknowledge our own wrongdoings, our own shortcomings, and have a quality of humility. Yes, I did wrong. Yes, I ask for forgiveness. So that very action of recognizing our failings, our wrongdoings, and asking for forgiveness is a very, in a way, central Buddhist tradition, particularly when we've spent time together, say at the end of a rains retreat. There's a formal asking for forgiveness if you've been on retreat together, or we spent time together with a group of people or with a particular teacher. When you part company, this is one of our customs, is to formally ask for forgiveness. That's how we kind of say goodbye to each other. you perform this little ceremony. And the Pali, you recite, Acharye Pamadena Dvaratayena Katang Sapang Aparatang Kamatame Bante. For whatever I have done that's heedless, and it's saying by body, speech, or mind, whatever I've done intentionally or unintentionally that might have been harmful to you or upsetting or distressing in any way, you try to cover all your bases. You know. Even if it's not all there in the text of it, you know, there's a formula that you recite, but the intention is whatever I might have done, whatever I might have said, or the way I walk, whether it was intentional or unintentional, conscious or unconscious, you know, whatever I might have done that was upsetting to you, accordingly, I ask for your forgiveness. And then one of the most beautiful aspects of this is then that the teacher or the person that you're addressing, the elder, then says, I forgive you and please forgive me also. And that's done even if the person that you're, even if you're an extremely sort of junior person or you're very young in the training, and the person that you're talking to is someone who's extremely senior or regarded as a fully enlightened being, they will still say, I forgive you and please forgive me also. I ask you to forgive me also. And so that even though it can be somewhat formalized, ritualized, that it's just a, in a way, it can be seen as a rote exchange, just a formula. It's what my own teachers, Lumpo Cha, Lumpo Sumedho, would always stress, was that it's important that you mean it. And it's also important that the teacher means it, because what you're doing is that even the teacher, even if they're an arahant, they're recognizing, well, even arahants can annoy people. You know, even like there in the suttas and in the Vinaya texts, there are actually several of our pati, the rules of our discipline are laid down by the misguided actions of some enlightened beings. The Buddha had to scold quite publicly. They're saying that even enlightened beings can do things that annoy others, like a particular incident where the great arahant Pindala Bharadvaja, like Mahamoggallani, had great psychic powers, and one day the a rich merchant in Rajagaha had set up a 100-foot pole and put on top of it this beautiful sandalwood bowl and said, okay, whatever yogi or sannyasin or anyone blessed with psychic powers can rise up and pick the bowl off the top of this 100-foot pole, then they can keep it and they can make it their own, this, you know, very precious object. And so there was this big commotion happening in the marketplace and all this activity. And I think it was actually Mahamoggallana was walking with Pindala Bharadvaja, and they're walking along and they say, what's that whole commotion going on there in the market? And someone said, oh, well, this rich merchant's put this beautiful sandalwood bowl on top of a 100-foot pole, and anyone who can rise up and pick it off the pole can keep it. Oh, Pindala says, well, all right. So he floats up into the air, takes the sandalwood bowl, does three laps of Rajagaha, and then flies back to the bamboo grove. Of course, that caused a bit of a commotion. And you know, all these people start crowding into the monastery and making a big kerfuffle. And so then the Buddha said, what are all these people doing here? What's all this commotion? What's all this activity? And then he hears that Pindala had flown up in the air and been displaying his psychic powers in public. And he says, ask Pindala to come here. You know, so he's an arahant. And then the Buddha, you know, brings him forth and gives him a good scolding in no uncertain terms. And he says, you know, that from now on it should be considered an offense for someone to display their psychic powers in public. This is not something that you should be doing, like you're kind of on stage in a you know, like you're performing, like a dancer on stage, you know, showing off your kind of abilities, like a street performer. So even arahants can cause upset. So in this asking for forgiveness, what we're doing is, say, recognizing that we affect each other. We have an impact upon each other. And that we are, even though we might have very good intentions, we might have a quality of conduct that we feel is absolutely harmonious and pure, it can still be the fact that we annoy other people. Even maybe our goodness is really irritating. That we do everything so well can be extremely upsetting to other people. And so this is a very beautiful way of clearing the slate. When you part company, of clearing the slate and recognizing that even with the best of intentions, we can annoy each other. And one of the powerful aspects and helpful aspects of this is, even if you don't really mean it, even if it's something in you says, well, you know, you really are out of order, and I don't, you know, I don't really want to be doing this. Just the very fact that you're hanging on to that attitude, that gets revealed at the moment where you put your hands together and say, please forgive me, and I forgive you also. The very fact that something in you wants to keep hold of it and doesn't want to to loosen the grip, at that moment, as you're reciting those words, then you notice that. You recognize, oh, there's something here that doesn't want to let go. There's something here that doesn't want to forgive. Now, what's that? Why is that so precious? Why do I want to carry that like a, you know, red hot iron ball? Why do I want to carry this around? This is only harming me. It's only, you know, harming the other. So why would I want to do this to myself? So even though it might be formulaic in some ways, it's like holding up a mirror to our own attitudes, our own kind of narrow-mindedness, our own quality of so self-cherishing in a way, that my view, my precious grudge is more important than my respect for you as a living being who can make mistakes. And that's difficult for us to see, but if we are able to recognize that, to acknowledge that, then we know that the thing to do next is to see that's a weakness on our part and to let go, to be humble enough to let that grudge dissolve. Now, sometimes that kind of insolubility when there's something that is in a way we've been carrying around for so long, or it's some situation that's so intractable or difficult, that you really can't come to an agreement, you really can't settle it. And the Buddha had a variety of ways that he presented for disputes and conflicts and difficulties in the community to get sorted out. You can ideally, we do things by, make decisions by consensus, and you come to a full agreement like that. If you can't do things by consensus, you go to a majority vote. Anyway, there's various different ways of settling disputes and discord. But there's a list of seven of them that we recite with the rules of training every fortnight. And the last one is called covering over with grass. And this means there's no way we're going to agree on this. You think A, I think B. You're sure you're right, I'm sure I'm right. Well, okay, let's just cover it over with grass and carry on. And that it's like, okay, well, we'll have to agree to disagree. And I've always felt that was a particularly... the Buddha was an amazing judge of human nature. He was extremely observant and a very, very astute judge of character and observer of human nature. And he realized that sometimes you can't agree. But you can. That's still not an obstruction to carrying on. We still live together. We're still related to each other. You can find a way forward, even though there are some irreconcilable differences, say, within the family, within a community, within the Catholics and the Protestants in Belfast, or the white community or the black community in South Africa, or whatever it might be, wherever it might be. That still we can cover things over with grass. And a few years ago, I came across a similar tradition in Hawaii, and they have this particular when you have some conflict within the village, within the community, that again is completely intractable. That there's two factions that are opposed to each other, and you've been back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and you can't come to any kind of settled agreement. There's this kind of community action that's called Ho'oponopono. I'm sure that's badly pronounced, but Ho'oponopono. And what they do is the whole tribe, the whole village gathers together, and they all agree, okay, this is impossible, right? This is completely impossible, but here we are. And then they all agree, okay, this is a Ho'oponopono. This is what it is. Okay, we all agree this is impossible, this is completely, we're unable to work this out. Okay, it's one of those, and here we are. And then they carry on. So I'm sure there's more to it than that, but I thought this bears a striking resemblance to the covering over with grass and the recognition of, sometimes there are a deeply... the rifts and the disagreements, the different ways of seeing things are so deep. But there is this capacity to recognize a bigger picture. There's something that's more important than my rightness or your rightness or the wrongs that have been done. And that to allow us the space to respect each other and carry on is the most important thing. Now, another of the aspects of forgiveness that I'd like to touch on is, say, for example, the monastery where I was living in California was called Abhayagiri. And in Pali, this means fearless mountain. A is a negative, Bhaya is fear, Giri is mountain. So literally it translates as fearless mountain. Now, for many Thai people, when they'd see the name Abhayagiri, they think, oh, this means forgiveness mountain. Because in the Thai language, apai means forgiveness. And so when Thai people would come and they say, why did you call your newsletter Fearless Mountain? what's the name got to do with fearlessness? And he said, well, actually, that's abhaya means fearless. They go, really? Because in the Thai language, there's a slight drift of meaning, but it's not that far from the original. Because to to forgive, when you don't carry a grudge around, no one needs to be afraid of you, right? And one of the qualities of dana, or generosity, that the Buddha described, along with amisa dana, the giving of material gifts, another level, or a superior level of generosity, of dana, is abhaya dana, to give fearlessness, or to give freedom from fear. So that, and often that's associated with keeping sila, keeping the precepts. So that if you are one who is dedicated to honesty, to non-violence, then other beings don't need to be afraid of you. Like in a monastery, you find the rabbits and the deer and such like, they kind of roam around quite freely because they know the humans are not going to harm them. So that the quality of abhaya, of fearlessness, is in that sense related to the quality of forgiveness. Because if you are always ready to forgive others, you're not carrying around resentment, you're not carrying around any kind of grudge, you're not carrying around that kind of negativity, no one needs to be afraid of you. Right? And so that the abhaya of abhaya giri then it's demonstrating or carries that same kind of meaning. And so forgiveness is not just something that say we are benefiting from ourselves. It's not just freeing our own heart from a burden of negativity or resentment or the desire for revenge, but it's also a gift to others. It's you're offering fearlessness. You're offering a freedom from fear. And when people know that you haven't got anything against them, sometimes they can think, they can be, afraid of us if people feel that they've done something worthy of criticism, or that we're going to blame them for some kind of harmful action or negative action. To be able to say to someone, "No, I have no negativity towards you. I'm not carrying any resentment. I really don't mind. I have no ill will towards you." Really? Part of us can't believe it. But when you've had that kind of experience, I'm sure all of us, most of us at some point have had that kind of encounter. And when someone realizes they really don't need to be worried about you or to be feel threatened by you, there's a tremendous relief and a happiness. Another story I read about recently, which I was very struck by, was I think it was in one of Malcolm Gladwell's books. I read it. Who wrote The Tipping Point and Blink. I think this might have been in Blink, I'm not sure. But he described how in the USA, a man had been wrongly identified by a woman who'd been attacked, a victim of an attack. And she'd wrongly identified this man in a identity parade. And he was in jail for 20 years. He had 20 years in jail. And even when the actual, after there was some doubt about whether the right person had been identified, and that when the woman was confronted with the actual attacker, she said, no, that's not him, it was the other guy. I remember, it was definitely him. And in the book, it was also about the frailty, the subjectivity of perceptions. But after 20 years, further evidence appeared and it became clear that she had been mistaken, to her amazement, that she had been mistaken and that the wrong man had been jailed for 20 years. When he was released, then she, with incredible anxiety and trepidation, went to him and apologized and said, "I'm terribly sorry. I really, I made a genuine mistake." And to her astonishment, he had no negativity towards her. He said, "We all make mistakes." He's obviously an amazing person. He said, "Hey, we all make mistakes, He said, "But you've lost 20 years of your life. Your entire youth was spent in the jail." He said, "Well, you didn't mean it, so I hold nothing against you." And they had this wonderful encounter. And they became firm friends, and they now travel around doing workshops. I wish I could remember their names, but they now travel around doing workshops on reconciliation, and sort of restorative justice, and that and telling their story, and also what she has gained by his lack of negativity, his generosity towards forgiving her, and the his capacity to not resent having been subjected to the system because of being he was a black American, and she was and therefore far more likely to be jailed than a white person. But he was his freedom from resentment and then the beneficial relationship that's come from that is something that they carry on using that as a gift to the society. Well, the last thing I'd like to say, just as a closing piece, is how when we think about forgiveness, you might feel that once we've forgiven someone or we have forgiven ourselves, that you come back to some kind of neutral point. But there's another dimension to it as well, whereby when we say let go of a sense of negativity, it's not just coming back to a neutrality, but there's also powerful positive forces that come through as well. Like for that woman, her experience of gratitude, amazement and gratitude to this wonderful man who'd been locked up for so long on her wrong evidence, and how what can come forth is a great brightness of heart. When, say for example, we can have a lot of resentment towards people who've harmed us, or say our family members, or people who have oppressed us in some way, or we feel that. And then, when we develop the quality of forgiveness and letting go of that resentment, then what that opens us up to is a quality of compassion. That even if someone really has done us harm, or we've experienced a lot of pain, just to recognize what a terrible state they must have been in order to have carried out those actions. You know, poor guy. What a state to have been in. How miserable a condition to live in, to have acted in that way. And then we can experience a genuine quality of compassion. Like, I speak of this particularly because of the negativity I used to have towards my father as a teenager. When I was a teenager, we had a lot of very intense differences of opinion, like screaming arguments, and I was doing the screaming. And it was, and I used to write him off as this sort of narrow-minded, bigoted. I mean, he was pretty racist and kind of narrow and conservative, and so on and so forth. And I carried around this terrible negativity and criticism of him, blaming him. And then it was interesting how it was when I got to the age he was when he married my mother, and then when I was born, that I started to get into my late 30s and early 40s, I began to in a way see myself in his shoes. And I started to get this feeling of, well, why on earth should he have known what to do as a parent? You know, he didn't get any instruction manual. He went to Edwardian, growing up in an Edwardian family, going to a ghastly boarding school, you know, all boys boarding school. How should he have had any knowledge whatsoever of how to look after the children or bring up a family? Why should I expect him to be so completely loving and understanding? His father was born in 1863. My grandfather was born in 1863. My father was born in 1913. He lived in a totally different universe to me, born in 1956 and growing up in the 60s. How on earth could he have empathized with a flower child? Really? You know, and I began to see that... What was coming forth after on the other side of the forgiveness was an enormous brightness of compassion. I thought, well, he did a really great job. You know, well done, Dad. And part of me was thinking, I can't believe I'm thinking this. Because it bore such a striking contrast to what had been there before. But something that I found a great beauty and is... there, along with forgiveness, is a real cherishing and rejoicing, a real quality of appreciation. The brightness of gratitude, of compassion and appreciation that that we have for other beings, even those who we felt have done us harm or done us wrong, that we can it can bring forth, you know, great joy and a delight, a brightness within us. So, speaking of joys and delights, the compassionate tea makers have been busy at work, so we'll finish with the opening reflections there, and we'll have a little pause for tea for 20 minutes or so, and then gather again about 25 past.